welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is finally episode number 451, which I wanted it to be last week, but it wasn't, for Wednesday the 27th of May 2015. My name is Martin Darlington, and with me across the pond, in fact across several ponds, is Jim Race in California. We're 10 hours apart, I think, Jim. Good evening, or good morning, I should say.
Good morning.
Jim's not been awake long. So, we have a show title, What Dreams Are Made Of. So, today's show is going to be about dreams.
Yeah, I think it just came out of my head, and I figured, as obviously with the Jorge Rossi show, this should be an outstanding weekend. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be just brilliant.
Yeah. This Mugello's interesting. What I did find surprising, considering, and I know they've been in the doldrums, we're talking about Ducati here. I was looking at the MotoGP.com website, and they always do the what all you need to know about Mugello. You know, it's had races there since 1986 or something, and they were saying that the last time Ducati were on the podium was when Casey Stoner won there in 2009, I think, or 2007 it could have been even. But it's like really surprising. I just think, I think that could possibly change again, because that I would imagine that bike will suit that course.
I think the bike will suit the front straight, and I think you're going to see both Debbie and Crazy Joe coming flying past the Yamahas on the front straight, and then I think the Yamahas are going to be very, very dominant in the rest of the course. It'll be interesting to see if the Hondas have the opportunity to, obviously they need to step up. Both Marquez and Danny are having issues. If I was going to make a pick, and I'll do it early in the show, I'm going to go either 99 or 46 on the top step. Both of them will be on the podium, you know, barring complications, if you will. And then I would expect to see Mark Marquez, on the third step, and then probably maybe Iannone and Debbie fourth and fifth. I've been pretty accurate so far this year. I may suck at the MCN Fantasy League, but I've been really good on the MotoGP.com league.
I don't know. I mean, that Ducati goes around corners. And the other thing is, of course, if they can get ahead on the straight using that pretty awesome power it's got, I can't help thinking about Qatar a couple of years ago where Rossi was saying, we were much faster than the Hondas in the corners, but every time I got to a corner, there was a Honda on the line I needed to be on, so I couldn't get past him. Then on the straight, we didn't have the grunt to keep up with them. They'd pull away, we'd catch up with them in the next corner, but again, you couldn't get past them. So I don't know, that might happen, but it'll be interesting anyway, certainly.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the bottom line is going to be fun to watch, and it's going to just be brilliant, as always.
I mean, Mugello is one of those classic tracks, you know, where someone just tied a paintbrush to a goat's tail and sent it off around the valley sort of thing. And I know you guys mentioned Austria last week, and supposedly Austria is exactly the same. It's not a Tilke track. It's an old school alpine hillside. The highest uphill, I think, was 12% climb, and the steepest downhill is 9%. So, you know, it's got some pretty good undulations in it.
Yep. Yep. No, it's going to be brilliant. And again, I'm looking forward to it, and all of you out in Motopodland should be as well. We did get an interview this week. So that's always nice to have. Matt Sinkowitz. At first I thought, and I actually opened the conversation, I'm like, I think you're the first PhD that we've had on the show. Which he kind of laughed at. He's like, well, I'm glad to up the intellectual level of Motopod.
Well, you couldn't really take it any lower, could you?
But then I just remembered, just before we started, I was like, oh, we had Doc Cost on before. And I'm pretty sure he's probably got a PhD.
and Martin Raines.
Oh, that's right, Dr.
Martin
Raines.
He's a doctor. He's a doctor. He's got a doctorate, so I'm guessing. Yeah.
Good Lord. And it still hasn't elevated our intellectual level, has it?
No, but they visit Raises for a moment, and then we sink back into the primeval slime once they've left.
Yeah. But that being said, perhaps there is a small measure that we can take to bring ourselves up to a higher standard, which I doubt because we're not that good at it.
Yes.
Anyway, Matt is the director of a new documentary called The Ragged Edge. And it is the Eric Buell EBR racing story. It's a half or not half hour, it's an hour documentary that is available for download on Vimeo. We'll have a link in the show notes. I really highly recommend that you folks out there watch it. It's really an interesting tale. Martin and the rest of the hosts have already had the opportunity to see it. I know I've seen it.
I haven't yet.
Okay. You definitely should. If you can't watch the first 10 minutes and go, okay, I'm watching this whole damn thing, then you're not a motorcycle fan.
And isn't EBR Eric Buell Racing?
Yes, it is.
So EBR Racing is Eric Buell Racing.
Correct.
it's like when people refer to NVG goggles, night vision goggles.
Yeah. Exactly. Or the CTR is didn't we or CRT? We used to call them CRT.
The CTR rules. CTR rules, wasn't it? Claiming no CRT teams.
Right.
Which is a claiming rule team.
Team. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We may get Mark Miller on this week. I've been chatting with him back and forth in email, but I think probably as you and I are speaking, Martin, he's landing on the aisle for the TT.
Yeah.
And obviously the TT is coming up starting next week. I'm very excited about that. And I've got a little bit of news about what I'm going to be doing for that because I am going next year again.
Fabulous.
Yeah, I'm quite stoked. We've got some new donators, subscribers, anything going on like that?
Yeah, we have another wonderful donation from Jared Shearer. So, Jared, thank you very much indeed. I believe Jared is a multiple or serial donor, donator, which is incredibly welcome. So thank you very much indeed for that. Listener feedback. yes. We had a couple of emails this week. One in particular sort of sparked some interest with a due sense of, oh no, here we go again. And I've got to try and find.
Basically, what we were asked as hosts was, who is the best racer of all time? And
this was from Phil Armstrong.
Okay.
Phil, you're very cruel.
Yes.
Phil said, no, Phil fronted up and he said, for me, it's Jerry Dunlop.
which I agree with from a railroad standpoint.
Exactly. That was my point. I was like, you know, it's so difficult. How can you compare Hailwood and Rossi, different eras? How can you compare Jerry Dunlop and, I don't know, Giacomo Agostini? You know, Agostini obviously did some real roads, but generally it was short circuit. Jerry was all about the real roads. John McGuinness, you know, it's different machinery now. Cyril Dupree, you know, he tackles the Dakar, and you just think all these different disciplines that people do. I don't think you can say, I think you can, as Rossi once said when he was asked, where do you see yourself? And he said, I see myself on the podium of history. But which step he never elaborated on. I think it's so difficult. Harry, I'm afraid I'm going to have to dob him in for a little bit of nationalism flag waving. He said, oh, that's really, 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 really difficult, which is absolutely true. He went, I don't know, Casey Stoner? And I thought, no, for pure talent, possibly top 10 of all time, I don't know. I'm sure lots of people could come up with convincing arguments against that, and other people with convincing arguments for, but greatest of all time, I think you've got to combine talent with achievement. And no, two world championships does not a goat make.
Yeah. And your those two words that you said was talent and achievement. And if he had had the longevity, say, of Rossi, yes, you could have said that perhaps the talent and achievement of Rossi and the longevity, that may have been a valid argument. I think I'm going to stick with you. I think at this point, it's Rossi in the modern era.
Yeah.
But as you say, things were different back when Ago was running. And
yeah.
So how do you pick? I mean, you should have given us a little bit more specification as to what our criteria should be, because I've seen this argument for years and years, like who, even back before Rossi had hit the record that he has now. And so, yeah, you really have to wonder. But we would be very curious as to what listeners think. Everybody obviously is going to have their own, what's that term, blinkered opinion?
Yes.
but if you'd like to write in and let us know, you can always do so. And listener email comes to motopod@motopodcast.com, comes to all the hosts. We listen, we read. You may get involved in an incredibly long email thread.
yeah.
Our only minorest apologies for that. Onto the MCN league standings, and this is where I kind of turn my ears off because I sucked this year.
The MCN actually, I'm a little bit miffed at these results. We've had a bit of a turnaround at the top of the table for reasons that become apparent when we cover the World Superbike results. We've now got at the top, let me just bring it up, is Steve James with MK Racing, who has been there or thereabouts. Steve's on 748 points, and he's 21st overall, so he's moved up one place.
Is
that no change?
Which is massively impressive, because
oh, goodness, yeah.
There's like 35,000, 40,000 people that are playing this game, and he's in 21st.
In second place, Ollie Kay, an old friend of the show. Ollie and his team, Trees, Trees, Two, Tree, Tree, is only 15 points behind him, 733. And he's come out. He's not been in the top three so far, I don't think. and then, do we have to have Scott in the hosts league? Then we've got Scott Bolton in third place, who's a recent addition to the hosts league because of all the wonderful interviews he's got us from America. Team Moto Dog, 716 points. So I was tied with Scott last week. He has knocked me into a cocked hat, as they used to say. So that's first, second, and third in the Motopod League. In the hosts, leading in third position is Scott Bolton with Team Moto Dog with 716 points, obviously. Flipping heck, I'm 37 points behind. I'm 15th. Slowly dropping away. Doha Donuts with 679. Jules is 55th. Desmo Burnouts 2015 with 601. Dave is 77th. Straw Bales Mediocre RT with 570. Harry is 108th with Necessary Faster 528. Jim 158th with Race Racing and 451. And in 188th place is Len Padilla with Moto Len and 395. We now have 228 members with three awaiting Harry's approval, assuming that they all have below 528 points. and we're going to be really nice now, and we may not always do this, but there is a transfer window open at the moment. So if you hear this before midnight on Friday, the 29th of May, British summertime, so 11 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, you can make up to three transfers. But there you go.
I'm pretty sure, Martin, this is the first year that I've ever been behind you.
Note, there was one of our early years where at one stage I was seventh overall, and I think I did top the hosts league at the end of that year. The one I used to get spanked at was the old Ride On 2 one, which
oh yeah, yep.
Yes,
yep.
I wasn't very good with.
Well, that's because we own the database, so I can just manipulate things and.
yeah.
All right.
But we've got a tremendous amount of people in there. It really is good fun, and it actually does add a little spice to the races when you're watching them.
No, I think so too. I keep making the mistake this year of trading out people that I think aren't performing well. I traded out Tom Sykes for the last series because I was like, oh, well, he's getting spanked by Johnny Ray. And what does he do? He turns it around, and with double races on every weekend and his turnaround, what are you going to do? There's nothing you can do to change it. That's why I said I liked it last year when you could change it every weekend. You had the opportunity to make adjustments.
Yeah.
And so I'm not so happy with the format. But as I said, on the MotoGP.com one, I'm doing extremely well. I've managed twice to either pick the absolute top five or six in a couple of rounds. So, picking the top two or three is not hard, but picking the top five or six is kind of an accomplishment in my book.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the different permutations for choosing, you know, who's going to get, you know, fifth or ninth is flipping heck. You know, and to do it consistently is quite an achievement.
Yeah. I felt pretty good about it. We got a bunch of news.
Yeah, we have actually quite exciting news. And I'm hoping with my newfound IT dodgy TV link skills, I might be able to actually watch this live this year. The Suzuka 8-hour. We already knew that Michael Vandermark and Casey Stoner are going to be two members of a Honda team. But we just had announced, which some people were disappointed because they were hoping that Rossi and Lorenzo would be going.
We totally knew that wasn't going to happen.
No. The days of the top riders going, I think, are gone. But Brad Smith and Paul Espargaro, the Tech 2R pair, are going to go. They're going to race alongside Katsuyuki Nagazuka, mm-hmm. three-time All-Japan Road Racing Champion, fighting for an unprecedented fourth win. MotoGP podium finisher, came second in Valencia in 2012, and they are going to ride a factory machine based on the YZF R1M, specially modified to race the 8-hour. And they haven't won for 19 years at Yamaha, so I think they'd be rather keen.
Yeah, kind of shocking. As I was looking back through the Wikipedia, has a great entry on Suzuka 8-hour, if you ever want to take a look at it. And looking back through it, it was... it's been even longer. Has it been longer? I think it was 2002 that the last American won one. That would have been Colin and Haga, I think. Just the vast variety of machinery that is run there. And those of you that don't look at it, World Endurance Racing, those machines are so markedly different than anything you ever see in Superbike, anything you ever see at MotoGP. Obviously, they're a bike that's intended for a very long period of time, and the bikes are probably the most kitted out Superbikes that you've ever seen. The factories throw every bit of effort they can into running the Suzuka 8-hour, way more than they do for the other World Endurance Cup events. They are just, super trick.
Yeah. And I think it's worth remembering that the Japanese manufacturers, to them, this is really, really big. This is really important stuff.
Well, especially Honda. I mean, it's their test track. So, yeah. They throw bass on, and I think they've won, the last 5 years or something like that?
Yeah, I think they do rather well there. Yeah. Well, I will assume that they test there and no one else is allowed to, because that's what Honda do.
You think?
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
All right. What else we got? I think this is interesting. FIM and Dorna have opened up talks with potential suppliers for Moto2 engines from 2019 onward. Now, okay, but I'm going to inject a little personal opinion here. I wish that they would open it up much like Moto3. But that isn't necessarily the case. HRC were recently confirmed to continue supplying the variant of the CVR600RR engine that we've had until 2018, but the organizer is apparently keen to ensure that a supplier will commit to a minimum of 6 years, that the teams will have to make massive adjustments, aka a total rebuild of frames, which is fine because that happens all the time. But they won't have to do that again 2 to 3 years later. I don't agree with that philosophy. I would like to see Moto 2 go to a more prototype class. Granted, that will cost the teams more, but you can do exactly what you've done with Moto 3 and limit things via the ECU.
Yeah, but don't forget, I mean, Moto 3, I was looking at some figures the other day, which I didn't put in the show notes, but Moto 3 bike or a Moto 3 package is about half as much again as a Moto 2. So teams that are running in Moto 3 and Moto 2, and some of them in MotoGP as well, or certainly hoping to, that's going to put a heck of a strain. And I know what you're saying, and there is an element. If you have some engine competition, then a team chooses the engine to go with, and if it's an R6 engine from Yamaha, and then 2 years later they decide to go to Honda, well, that's their choice. So if they've got the money to do it, then, you know, fine.
It was funny. When Moto 2 came out, we had a bunch of different frames, at least, and I was super happy with that. But it's almost become a cookie-cutter class at this point. And, you know, primarily Calyx frames, a few speed-ups, the Mistral, and maybe a Suter scattered throughout. It's like okay, and that's not to say that the racing isn't good, just that I like variety. I mean, I think I know you do too.
Yeah, so anyway, yeah, Moto 2, be interesting to see if Yamaha, who did make a strong bid for the original engine contract, come in and try and knock Honda off their perch.
But even that doesn't make sense. Well, perhaps if...
Why not?
Because right now the R6 engine is about as aged as you can get. It hasn't changed in 6 years.
No. I think Honda have said that the CVR600 engine is going to reach the end of its life cycle. So they'll come up with a brand new engine to put forward for their bid, should they choose to do so. I'm sure they will. And Yamaha would have to do the same. I mean, but we're looking, you know, the bids will have to be, the tenders won't be offered till next year. And then I'll have 2 years to sort of, you know, get it sorted out. So,
but I mean, okay.
But we may have someone like KTM come in or MV Agusta. That would be funny, wouldn't it?
Mm, yeah, triples. That might be fun.
It would, the grid, it would be, you know, and they're off. And it would be right, let's have a sweepstake on what proportion of the grid actually manages to leave the grid and hasn't broken down already. They'll look beautiful, though.
If nothing else, I would like the bikes to all sound a little bit different.
I'd like Suzuki to provide the engine because I think the GSXR 600 has got one of the most purposeful howling yells that you're going to hear anywhere. I think it sounds great, but that's an engine that's even older than me.
Nearly.
No, actually it's not, but it probably is nearly as old as Harry. Anyway, moving on. As expected, Mattia Bassini will be wildcarding a Moto2 at Mugello for the Federal Oil Gresini team, with whom he tested recently. He'll be alongside Xavier Simeon, who currently is their only rider. And it's worth noting, Bassini's won twice at Mugello before, on a 125 in 2006 and on a 250 in 2009. Was that when he was wearing that crazy one-off sponsorship pink outfit, or was that Misano? I think that might have been Misano. Yeah. But anyway, you know, Mattia Bassini is no mug. So it'd be interesting to see him and maybe a career resurrection if he runs well.
There will be. Bassini is always fun to watch, too. I mean, he truly brings the wild to the term wild card.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'd quite like looking forward to seeing him and Sam Lowe's going around or every corner sideways. But what I don't get about Sam is how he does that, and he's so blinking quick with it. But I suppose, you know, the bike's lined up for the next straight before everyone else has got their wheels in line.
Yeah, I'm always curious how he doesn't just completely destroy his tires. But
well, this is the Gary McCoy thing that he discovered, though, wasn't it? That actually you don't damage the interior by spinning it up. You just warm the carcass. And yeah, you abrade it a bit, but it didn't have a destructive effect. It just had a gradual deterioration.
Well, I don't know. McCoy's slideways activity maybe not have destroyed the tires very much, but it certainly beat the shit out of him.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I had a thought which is so bleeding obvious, it's probably not worth mentioning, but my thought was, oh, I hope Bridgestone don't have a tyre contract to the end of the year and the Valencia test will feature Michelin tyres, because that'll be the first time, because none of the current Michelin tests are done with active riders, I don't think, certainly not from the Premier Class.
They did at Sepang, but you remember there was a whole press boycott for it, so nobody could...
Yeah, and there is no timings released whatsoever, but at Valencia, there will be.
Yep.
And that was going to be fascinating. Well, I assume there will be. I mean, Michelin are going to cause a lot of cynical eyebrows to be raised, or eyebrows to be raised cynically. Not sure if you can have a cynical eyebrow. If they don't release timings, because people will be like saying, well, hang on a sec, that means you're absolutely miles behind Bridgestone. And as you and Harry have been saying all season long, or since it was announced, Bridgestone are going to put maximum effort in this year to break every lap record they can and make it really difficult for Michelin to catch up.
I think one of the things that will be interesting is that, for next year, we're going to 17-inch wheels. The tires that Michelin are coming out with and that they tested with at Sepang, however, even on a 17-inch wheel, are basically the same diameter in a radial fashion as the Bridgestone 16.5s. So the teams didn't do any setup. They just put, you know, spoon the new tires onto their existing rims or 17-inch rims and went out and ran. Now, we know that I think it was both Debbie and Lorenzo had some pretty high-speed crashes.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, and the difference between the two, but nobody did any setup. So it will actually be incredibly interesting, because this will be the first opportunity the teams have had to do setup. I suppose we could probably drop an email into Mike Webb and ask him what the scoop is on this and see, because it's a great question and I would like to know the answer. Are we going to have to wait? There's no point in doing the winter tests on Bridgestones with a chassis that is not set up for Michelin. So it's a great question and a great speculation. And my assumption is that, yes, we will be switching to Michelin right away. But what does that mean? Well, that means that right now there's a ton of development effort going on with the teams to develop a chassis that is made for Michelins, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that is going to be tough. I mean, I don't know if it really contributes anything to the conversation, but I'd just like to say...
God, I hate you.
Sorry. Yes. I'm an easily hateable person. Actually, talking about sad news, which is basically that Jim's on probably his third strong coffee, still waking up, and I'm on my second and final Guinness. Donington World Superbikes, which we'll get onto the races shortly, they're very good. 30,000 people came through the doors across the 3 days, 15,000 people on race day. People who attended all 3 days got counted three times. Only about 6,000 were there on the Friday. The Spanish GP at Jerez this year had 243,000 people over 3 days. And the point they're making is there were more Brits on the podium in Donington in either race than Spaniards on the GP podium. Last year, the British Grand Prix at Silverstone attracted 138,000 across 3 days. And Donington's now the only British World Superbike round. They don't go to Silverstone anymore. You know, what is wrong with World Superbikes? It is not bringing the viewers in. I don't know how the TV audience is going. I know they were hoping there'd be a bit of an upturn this year, but...
But from part of my understanding and talking to some people about it, is that, for one thing, the ticket prices were way too high.
Right.
And so people that were talking about it basically said, well, I can spend half as much and I can go to a BSB round where there's going to be tons of people and very close racing and still have a bunch of British racers.
And with the money you save, you can then go to the next BSB round and see the continuity and the story progress,
right,
and meet up a bunch of the same people that you went to, that, you know, depending how, you know, yeah, local the races are. But no, absolutely. It sounds like heresy, but I'm beginning to wonder if Dorna, who sadly earned them both, are going to think in the next 2 or 3 years, I don't know if this is commercially viable.
Well, no, it doesn't matter to Dorna because they're still getting the sanctioning fee. It's still being watched. The interest over here in the States was massive. I mean, the one thread that I'm participating in on a particular bulletin board has like 1,300 posts about the race, and it was a great race and well worth watching. So that's the kind of thing they look at, and TV revenues are, you know, they're staying solid. I think it's fine for them. I just think that they should probably not do what they do and, you know, raise sanctioning prices, you know, keep it relatively level, because it may not be Donington's fault that they had to charge that much. They were just trying to recoup costs, which I'll bet they didn't.
No.
Yep.
No. It'd be interesting to see when the Circuit of Wales comes up running, if they pick up a round. I should imagine they will do.
Yep.
If only to test it for MotoGP.
Well, I'd like to see them build the track first.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't know about this one. Bit of a sad story.
I need to call Sylvain and ask him about this, because I'd love to hear it in his own words. Apparently, Sylvain Guintoli has moved his 2014 World Superbike Champion Trophy from his living room down to his summer house. His wife was worried that someone had stolen it, but Ginter simply said, "I need to focus on this year, not look at last year." Overall, it seems he is having a tough time this year. He switched to the Honda, which is yet another aging steed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, I think the thing is, we all expected him to have a tougher time than he did last year on the Aprilia. We didn't expect him to be getting beaten by his teammate, which he frequently isn't, but that's generally because Marco van der Mark has crashed. when he finishes, I think the Ginters has beaten him once or twice, but, you know, he should be... His experience and his skill should be putting him comfortably ahead, I would suggest, of a rookie. Unless Marco van der Mark is a real precocious talent.
He certainly was in Moto2. It's just very odd to see a number one plate running that far back all the time. And I'll leave it at that. And on top of that, as everybody that listens to the show well knows, Sylvain is just a very nice guy. You'd really like to see him do well. So I will probably give him a holler, and American isn't there, right? See if I can get an update on what his mindset is for the year. I think it'd be well worth it for the show.
Yeah, dig in and wait for the new Fireblade, or whatever the replacement's called.
Yep.
Eugene Laverty is going to get the new Honda swing arm for Mugelli, this one that Harry was referring to with the hole stance, the rectangular hole stance in it. Nicky Hayden used it at Le Mans and did noticeably better. He was the first, he made it through to Q2. It was the first open bike. And the only notable open crash during the race was Jack Miller. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if Eugene can, you know, make the same steps with it that Nicky did. And in another improvement, Aprilia are going to race a full seamless gearbox at Mugello. They haven't hung around with that, have they? Suzuki now the only team without a seamless gearbox, although theirs, I believe, is coming along fairly soon. The word is Bautista gained a full second in the new gearbox in recent testing. Now, if they give it to Marco Melandri as well, he could be less far behind the second from last person in the next race.
He hasn't always been last, but that.
No, God, he hasn't. That's why. No. And I'm. It sounds awful. It sounds like I'm. You know, riffing on his pain. I'm not. But it's Marco Melandri. Exactly my point. It is not Alex Hoffman or. Goodness, how can you pick out another serial slow person that we don't really have them, do
nope.
we?
Because they don't don't stick around long.
No. Olivier Jacques wasn't particularly quick, but then he was on a dog of a bike, and he was bloody quick when he was in 125s and 250s. So, you know, I can't really pick on names, but Marco Melandri, you know, he's been a GP winner. The last privateer GP winner that we've had, which was God 9 years ago, you know, he's been second in a title race to Rossi. He shouldn't be back there.
Yeah. No, I agree. And there's a lot of people out there that are like, oh, send him back to the psychiatrist. I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is that we basically got a underdeveloped bike waiting until 2016, when the rules become more in their favor.
And maybe they've developed it to suit the Michelin, or how you do that before you've actually been given a go on them, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yoda Racing lost their main sponsor, Octo Technology, or something it's called.
Telematics.
That's it, Telematics. Yeah. Octo Telematics. Not quite sure what the implication is yet for Alex De Angelis and Florian Alt. But Yoda are quite a possible team to give up their spot for the likes of KTM or a privateer Suzuki outfit, or they could carry on as a pretty satellite team. And then after that was put in the show notes, we all noticed breaking news: Pramac Ducati named their new title sponsor Octo Telematics. So it's now the Octo Pramac Racing. I mean, I thought Pramac were the title sponsor of the Pramac team. Pramac make generators and electrical things.
Well, it's,
you know, plants.
It's a perfect match. Octo Telematics and Pramac generators.
Yeah, they said the new title sponsor. I'm thinking, but you're being called Pramac Ducati. Doesn't that make Pramac the title sponsor? But anyway, title sponsor.
I just put that in from the press release. That was what they called themselves.
Absolutely. Yep. No, but when I was reading it on Twitter, and then I read the press release, and it's like, okay, it's like the Movistar Yamaha racing team announced the arrival of a new title sponsor, Fiat. So now the Fiat Movistar. And it's, okay. Anyway, true. That hasn't happened, by the way, before people think we're going back to Fiat.
Go ahead.
You've got a rumor about someone coming to America.
I do, and I usually don't participate in rumors, but they're and I'm actually.
Oh, I've heard you do. That was only a rumor, though, so I don't believe it.
I hear that Sheridan Marais may be coming over to the U.S. We know that Dustin Dominguez has been released from the HSBK Aprilia squad. I have heard that it's a possibility that Sheridan Marais, the South African rider, may be coming over to replace him. I don't know if that is a hard and true fact, but there are whispers in the background. I could be wrong, and if I am, then I take it all back. But I rate Sheridan Marais, and I have for years.
Where is he still in World Supersport?
I'm not even sure where he's running right now. Either
where is Sherry Murray? Yeah. If anyone knows, like my own mate Google, please, you know, give us a bell or drop us a line and let us know.
I probably got his phone number. I should just at least look it up and give him a call. I'm not sure if we mentioned this last week, but Split Bath Racing, who has run in BSB, of course, has also been running with Mark Miller and last year Brandon Cretu, will be running despite the EBR receivership that occurred. And this will be talked about in the interview you're going to hear right after this. Will be returning to the TT with no factory support, but they'll be running on the EBR 1190 RS machines with riders Mark Miller and new teammate Hudson Kenna, who just won Superstock at the last BSB round, I think. Martin, can you confirm that? I'm not sure.
It's the what, sorry?
Superstock at the last BSB round.
I have no idea. Okay. I loosely follow BSB and rely on Dave to educate me about everything else.
And I'm pretty sure he's third in points. He's been doing really well. He was lightning quick last time he was at the Isle. Split Bath also intends to contend Macau again on the same machinery. They also intend to return to China with American Corey West to defend their championship plans as well. When they went out there, they won both races last year. So that's pretty cool. I think that they're very bold, and as you'll hear right after this, we have the interview with the gentleman that did the EBR documentary, and he's got some thoughts on it as well. So, Martin, since we've mostly gone through the news, unless you have something else, do you want to roll that interview?
Let's roll the interview.
Zoom, zoom. Jim Race here for Motopod with Matt Sinkowitz. Matt is the director of a new documentary that just came out, basically detailing the history of Buell, its ups and downs. And it just came out with very interesting timing, as you well know, Matt. But I actually have to say, I think this is the first time with the hundreds of people that we've interviewed for the show that I've had a PhD on. So well done.
Thanks for having me on, Jim. I'm glad to, raise up the educational standards of the program. It's good to have that function.
I have to ask, and the first thing that came to mind when I was wondering about talking to you was, how does somebody in your particular study of communications and remind me again in our listeners what your PhD is in?
My PhD is in media and cultural studies from the University of Wisconsin.
Okay. So how did you end up being a director for a film about a motorcycle company and motorcycle road racing?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a serendipitous kind of thing that came along. So my day job is as a college professor. So I teach at Boston College,
right?
And I teach courses in media theory and globalization and this sort of thing. But this project came along actually while I was in Wisconsin doing my PhD. And it actually, the origin of the project was through my co-producer and co-director, Joe Sousa. And so Joe is a TV producer, sort of that's his main gig. And he was producing a show for the History Channel called Sliced.
Ah, yes. And
Sliced was a show, it was on history. I'm not sure quite what the history connection was, but what they would do is they would take objects of interest from, you know, American history and cut them in half in order to see how they worked or something. And one of the things they cut in half was an EBR. And so Joe did this. He did the show. The show was all right. But what was really interesting was his conversations with Eric on the sidelines and, you know, in between takes and this kind of thing. And so I'm working in Wisconsin. I'm working in Madison, which is about 80 minutes from East Troy, which is where EBR and Buell have been based. And Joe gives me a call and he says, I just met this guy. He's fascinating. He's like a little bit nuts, but in like a really good way. Why don't you go down there, check it out, see if you think it's a story worth telling. And, you know, I didn't specifically have an interest in motorcycles at the time. I've sort of developed one as a result of the project. But I had a lot of interest in this sort of notion of a subculture, you know, a group of people who take a specific interest in something and really make a lot of meaning out of it. You know, I had this interest in Wisconsin. I had an interest in the idea of a culture that was going to look at something that I wasn't too familiar with, but really take a lot of meaning out of it. I showed up in East Troy. I met Eric, and he was, just as Joe suggested, sort of this fascinating, like, a little bit manic, but like incredibly vibrant person. But more than anything, what struck me was just how meaningful this motorcycle was to the people in East Troy. That having made Buells there, making EBRs there, it just meant so much. And so to me, as a scholar of culture, a scholar of somebody who likes to look at the ways in which people make meaning out of their world, EBR was such a central part of the kind of meaning making of people in East Troy, Wisconsin. I felt like this is a story that just needed to be told.
It and in more ways than one, because that was a huge part of the economy in that town.
Oh, tremendous. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, the it's a small town. It's a really small town. You drive through. It's got this beautiful town square. We show it a few times in the film. And that's like the whole town. You know, there's some houses out around it, but it's really tiny. And, you know, you take a company like Buell was and EBR had become. That is not just a lot of jobs in and of itself, but those are also the jobs that keep all the other businesses in town alive.
Of course.
You know, the lunch counter downtown, right? Who were the customers? They were Buell or EBR employees. You know, the gas stations, right? Who's filling up? It's not a town that people drive through so much. You know, people commuting in and out to work at EBR. So it was a tremendous blow the first time when Harley came in and broke up the company. And that's when we started our story, seeing these people, you know, a lot of people unemployed, but then a lot of people in the surrounding town also suffering as sort of a ripple effect.
I really have to encourage our listeners to go and watch this, because the epicness of the opening of your film, where everything is getting thrown into the dumpster, is one of those things. As a long-term motorcyclist, I've been riding for 47 years, is one of those things that your heart sinks and you're like, God.
Yeah. No, that's right. That was actually the moment that, so me and Joe Sousa, my co-producer, the moment we were debating whether or not we wanted to make this movie. And the moment we decided we were going to do it is when we saw that footage. And it is, it's a brutal little piece of footage to watch. These you know, beautiful machines, right? That people, even more than the machinery, right? People had poured their souls into it.
Right.
And then, you know, because of some, you know, liability issue or whatever it was, you know, they were throwing them in a dumpster. And like, it's poetic in a way, but in like a really sad way. So yeah, seeing that footage really affected me and made me think this is something I want to tell people about.
There was, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there was an ad that was placed into many motorcycle magazines that had when they discontinued the Buell Blast, and that was kind of the first shot across the bow, if you will, for Buell. And that was when they took one and they crushed it into a cube. They put it in the desert and they said, the Blast is no more. And there were people around the world that said, ooh, this is kind of the death knell. Pardon me while I open another one. All right. Carry on. Yeah, go.
Well, no, I mean, I have not seen that. I mean, I'd be interested too. It's a strange bit of imagery to be putting out there and sort of prescient. I mean, that is exactly what happened to, you know, the whole stock of bikes there, is they were literally destroyed.
Did you ever try and talk to any of the folks at Harley to see what their thoughts were, and how did that go?
We sure did. You know, as just telling a responsible story, we reached out, and they were not interested in talking to us. I mean, we were careful in this film to try to give Harley a fair shake. And you know, there's nothing in the film which you know, specifically you know, points to any malfeasance on their part. I mean, you know, we don't know exactly what was going on. But you know, you can see it in Eric's eyes that he, and you know, you can watch the film and just look at him, you know, talking to us. And you know, I don't think he felt like he was done, you know, the service that he could have been by Harley. But he also notes that it was a tricky time. I mean, this was right in the heart of the Great Recession. So no, we tried to talk to Harley. Harley didn't reach out. I think there's a note in the film that you know, Harley was unavailable for comment. And you know, we left it at that. We didn't want this to be a story about sort of the specifics of, you know, who did what to whom. It was really, I mean, partly what we just wanted to focus on was Eric trying to get back. But also there's a bigger systematic question when you look at Eric's attempts to raise money and kind of work in the corporate world. And, you know, it's not just Harley. Something about, you know, kind of Eric's individuality doesn't sit perfectly well with the world of American finance.
Which is, in my personal opinion, good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's good. It's good until it turns out that he can't
raise more capital.
Raise the money. Yeah. No. I mean, it's what makes it's why people love him. You know, it's why people love his bikes. I mean, he's doing things. He's done things. I mean, I forget the number of patents that he has, but you know, a lot of these are things that big companies would be afraid to try. You know, and his creativity is what makes him great. But it's also what makes him, I think, a little bit unnerving to a company like Harley. And I suspect that to a certain extent, you know, the kind of the true innovation that Eric represents is not something that all corporations are interested in.
Well, Harley has had a history, and without harping on them either, has had a history of associating with very interesting companies, coming up with ideas that for a while they were making some very interesting race bikes. Associated with AMF, the same people that make bowling alleys, but they were, those were essentially air Machis, and they were super fast. They actually won some championships, or at least championship races, international. They raced in the AMA for a while with a not so successful bike that was painted orange on one side and black on the other. That thing was stellar. They raced in the AMA and had some very interesting modifications that he'd used to. I can't actually delve completely into the story, but they kind of skirted the rules a bit. It was a sad day when that happened, and I think Eric had joined up with them simply to keep the company going.
Right.
That happened, and a bunch of people lost their jobs, and there was certainly some unhappiness in East Troy, as you well documented. But then the Phoenix rose from the ashes.
Yeah. I mean, this was, you know, it was rising before it died, if that is possible. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that from the minute, Eric got the news that he was closing, he knew he was opening again in some form or another. And you know, this is the beautiful and perhaps, you know, some ways the tragic element of the film is, I mean, it is just remarkable to see how willing he was to go back at it immediately, mostly investing, you know, personal capital or, you know, drawing on, you know, people he knew. You know, we start the film and the company is, it depends how you count it, but single digits employees, something like that.
Right.
It's basically Eric. He's got a race team. He's got a couple people working in the factory. You know, sort of the remnants of the Buell factory, and that's where the film picks up. It picks up basically, you know, Eric just got knocked down. He's dusting himself off. And, you know, we show him walking through this, you know, this dark, empty warehouse, right? And you think, you know, how you know, it's just amazing. It goes from being this vibrant place to completely shut down. You know, when I was there, I remember thinking, like, I sure hope this works out. It doesn't look so good, right? This giant, empty, like, huge warehouse. But as we show in the film, it starts getting to go.
When you interviewed some of the employees, I remember one particular gentleman you were interviewing in his house. And he had this sallow, beat down look on his face. And when it reopened, he looked like a new man.
It was amazing. Yeah, yeah. I think you're talking about Jason, who's who's, you know, we use him to represent sort of the body of the employees largely in the film. And, you know, it was that sallow look was I mean, that's a perfect way of putting it. You know, the amazing thing, and if you want to feel really proud of sort of, you know, the possibilities of American entrepreneurship, or just entrepreneurship in general, you know, you can look at this guy, Jason, who he's working for Buell, his life's the way he likes it. He loses that job. He starts doing sort of, you know, this kind of very drudging sort of labor he doesn't like. And, you know, it just completely saps the life out of him. Right. But then Eric comes back and all of a sudden he's got a job where he feels connected, where he gets to actually see some product of his labor. You know, he's working all day, but then he goes out and he sees people riding these bikes, and it completely changes him. I mean, you can just see it in his face. He lights up. And this is an experience that we all have. I mean, we all know that when you, you know, you sit there working during the day and you feel like it's all kind of, you know, it's just for the paycheck. Right. And maybe the paycheck isn't so great. You know, this is just draining. But the company that Eric was able to build back up, give Jason and people like him jobs that made waking up in the morning, you know, not something they didn't want to do, right? It gave them a feeling of satisfaction at the end of the day. It's really satisfying to see people happy, you know, with their work. And it shows you that an innovative company, you know, with a little entrepreneurship can, you know, not just be, you know, about making a product. It can be about making people's lives better, you know, first and foremost, the employees.
I mean, I think to a person, when you were talking to people, other people, of course, that were working in the factory, they were all like, we come to work and it's not a job. It's just like, I can't even, you could probably quote them much better than I can, but.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, that it's the people who say it's not a job, it's fun. I mean, I think the even more telling is, you know, it's not a company, it's a family.
Right.
And these kinds of things, you know, I guess if you saw it on paper, it might almost seem cliche. Mm-hmm. But when you see people say it, you know, like when you see their eyes and the glint in their eyes, and you realize, like, no, you know, your life is really, really, you know, largely shaped by, you know, who you spend those 8-9 hours a day at work with.
Right.
And if you feel like you're with family and you're doing something collaborative and important and creative, man, that's, you know, that's a third of your life, right? It's a lot better. And, you know, the people who Eric brought back to work, you know, I think that even though, as I'm sure we'll get to, the end of the story isn't as happy yet as we'd like it to be, you know, even just having those, you know, couple years they came back doing a job that really, really made them feel like they were contributing and they were part of something. I think that's a tremendous achievement.
Now, and moving on, they put in a ton of work. Now, and I'll say unfortunately, but not to your detriment, that you never quite got to the World Superbike part of the story, which is going on now, or unfortunately is not going on now. But some of the additional racing, you did get to spend a fair amount of time in the AMA paddock working with the team.
We did, yeah. I mean, this was one of the real joys of the production. Yeah, we spent we did two full race weekends, you know, with the team, and I mean, this was my first time at an AMA race. I had seen them on TV, but that was about the extent of it. And so I got to be in there, right in the paddock with Jeff May and with the race team, you know, we've got you know, we were thrilled with the access that we were able to get. You know, I kind of. In my mind, I thought, I mean, this is big time sports. They're not going to let me, you know, stand right out on the track, you know, listening in on their strategy conversations and these kinds of things. But in fact, they did. And so it was eye opening, one, just to see how much work goes into this. But, you know, also it's just really fun. You know, I mean, the kinetic, the energy is just, it's right there. And I think it shows up on the screen, too.
No, it does. There was another memorable scene where Eric was practically teary-eyed, where he's like, "Oh, this is what I wanted to do." And you can also see, if there's one word that I could use for Eric, it's passion. It may not always be properly directed, but but the man has a serious amount of passion.
Yeah, he cares, you know, yeah. And like that's an underrated quality in the world, right? It's really easy to get jaded, especially, you know, when you're you know, getting beat down every so often. And, you know, Eric, the film shows him up and down, but it shows him up and down, not in a, you know, not, he's not like depressed when he's down. He's trying to figure it out.
I don't know. That opening scene, he looked a little depressed.
He's depressed. Okay, that's fair. But after that, I think. That's depressing. Yeah, the scene where he's announcing. Yeah, when he has to tell people terrible news. I guess that's a different story.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, the middle, you see him sort of faced with anxiety. You see him really worried. But it's a productive anxiety. I mean, it's somebody trying to figure out how to make this thing go. And, you know, the thing that drew me to him was the fact that I truly believe that he, you know, he deep down cared about this, not just for himself, but for the people around him. And, you know, that is, you know, that's for somebody at his level of achievement. It's not always the case, right? A lot of people are in it for themselves. I didn't think he was. And that's part of where his passion came from. Part of it was that he just loves to innovate. He loves to make motorcycles, and you can tell that. You know, we show him at the beginning of the film, just in his shed or what people call the barn.
Right.
You know, he's going through. He's showing us all these old stuff, like back when he used to make his own calipers and these like crazy. I mean, I didn't think people did that. Part of it, he loves bikes, right? But he also really did care about the people around him. And every single minute of the film, to me, when I watch it, here's a guy who's, you know, partly about the art of producing motorcycles, but that art's for a purpose. It's for the purpose of getting people back to work, of giving people a sense of achievement, creating a community, and so on.
Do you ride?
I don't. I have to confess.
No, just curious. I mean, it's a valid question.
No, it is. It is. But I have to plead the fifth. I guess I should just said no comment.
So that was your first attendance at an AMA race. Which was that?
It was. It was. The first one was Millville, Millville, Ohio. Is that the town? I think it was.
Okay.
Yeah, Millville. Yeah, Millville, Ohio was the first one, and then we also got to do New Jersey, which is the town in New Jersey? It's skipping my mind, but
New Jersey Motorsports Park.
That's right. Yeah. So those were my first two. I mean, I should say that there's not much of it in the film. It's actually really kind of frustrating. The most interesting experience I might have had, and I'm the most interesting experience I had, is that I actually rode out with the race team in the truck, from East Troy to Millville, Ohio. And, they are so understaffed. I mean, you know, they said they were going to try to leave at like 5 or whatever, but they had two guys doing everything. And so they actually don't end up leaving until like 3 a.m. We show up in Millville, like, I don't know how long it took. It took 10 hours or something. No sleep, for like, I don't know, an hour and a half or something. Get up back, go to the racetrack. I mean, it was just this absolute, I mean, the commitment that the crew had, was just amazing. And so I got to see it from the whole process, from loading up the truck to, you know, stopping in the middle of the night for a sandwich to showing up at the track and getting things going. And then when I saw the sort of vastly larger, you know, groups of personnel the other crews had, it really kind of put in perspective the uphill battle that they were climbing.
Boy, could I tell you some stories.
I'm sure.
I've done the same thing myself. So as we progress along, we get to the decline once again, and that must have been, in a way, almost depressing to document.
Yeah, I mean so we were all too happy, all too excited for this to end up as a pure happy story. And you know, the original last few minutes of this film are, you know, Eric talking about these incredibly just these really cool, innovative bikes that he was making with Hero. And you know, the company was stable. We had interviews back with the employees, you know, saying how they're back and how their lives are, you know, they're looking up now. And that we were done with the film, and then of course this receivership kicks in. You know, we at this, you know, all we could really do to address it was sort of, you know, put up a text there. And it was a hard thing for us. I mean, You know, we wanted the film to be a celebration, not a memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully, I mean, like, I don't think the story is done. And I, you know, I'm not sure, I'm not going to speak to the future, but I, you know, I think I'm sure Eric's got a few plays to make. But, you know, we wanted it to be a celebration of a comeback, but it turned out to be, at least at this point, you know, more of a memorial to you know, this great effort, but one that put out some real achievements. And I think, you know, some people I see commenting like, oh, you know, doesn't the you know, unhappy ending kind of undermine it? And I don't think so at all. I mean, I look at the bikes they put on the road. I look at the achievements on the track. I look at the people who worked there during these years that they were back. I hope that it comes back. I mean, don't get me wrong. I will be very, very happy when I you know, get an email that they're opening the doors again. But even if that doesn't happen to be the case, you know, what Eric was doing here was fighting against, you know, fighting giants.
Right.
You know, on the racetrack, he's fighting giants, right? He's fighting the big mega, you know, multinational companies. On Wall Street, he was, you know, maybe not fighting, but, you know, trying to wrestle with giants or something, trying to get them on his side. That's something to be, you know, it's something I think it's interesting to watch. Hopefully viewers do too. But B, I think it's something to celebrate in and of itself, regardless of how it ends up.
I think a big part of it is the underdog story. Because he tried a lot of things that a lot of people went, what are you doing? When he was fighting on the track, now granted, he won a couple of championships in the AMA. Well mm-hmm. done. A gentleman mm-hmm. named Danny Eslick. It's not like he didn't have success on the track. It's going to be I say the same thing. I think this is a speed bump, a larger one than it was before.
Right.
I would not be surprised if we see him back in some form or another. And what I don't want to see is that opening scene again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? I mean, for those of you who, you know, if you go out and you see the film, you can we can talk about how you can see it. You know, we've got the online version now. We will at some point sit down back with Eric, and we're kind of waiting and hoping that that's the opposite of that video that we show at the beginning of the film of the shutdown. We hope it's a video announcing, you know, what's next, and we can put that onto maybe a DVD as an extra, or tack it onto the end of the film to get that sense. That would be ideal.
Yep. I what I would like to see is the lights flicking back on, and people, the employees walking back in going, thank God.
Yeah, no, right. Like, yeah. And they do, you know, they describe it as sort of a nightmare. You know, it is this sort of thing, just the way that it comes and goes. So yeah, that would be ideal. Hopefully we will eventually get a video that does the exact opposite of the shutdown video we started our film with.
Yep. So it sounds to me like you are interested in doing a part two.
You know, I mean, we're certainly interested in continuing with the story. If the story is there and if there's stuff to document, I mean, you know, I love East Troy. I really came to really appreciate the space and the people there. You know, I'm always up for a conversation with Eric. I know you've had him on the podcast. He's just a fascinating guy to talk to and be around. So if there's more story there, yeah, I'm certainly up for grabbing the camera and seeing what Eric has to say.
Have you now turned into a road racing fan?
Well, you know, I don't want to be quizzed, but I will say now that I certainly followed Jeff May, who I followed you know, throughout the course of the documentary. I've certainly found myself, you know, when I flip through the channels or I see it, I watch it. I have not had the time to fully, you know, vest myself in it, but I did, just from seeing the behind the scenes, get a much better sense of the incredible skill that went into it, which I, you know, I kind of knew, but I didn't know, you know, from firsthand experience. So I wouldn't say that I've become a big fan. I'm definitely, I appreciate it, and I'm interested in learning more.
We need to drag you out to a World Superbike or MotoGP race here in the States.
Oh, hey, I'm always up for it. Let me know.
Hey, there are plenty going on, my friend.
No, I want to be a personal guest of Jim Race.
we will talk shortly.
All right.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. We've talked to probably the other director that we've talked to a lot is Mark Neal, who did the entire Faster series. You may or may not be familiar with that.
I am familiar. Yeah, we definitely watched that in preparation for producing this.
Okay. And he's a big fan of the show and somebody I consider a good friend. I would love to see what else you come up with. And if you ever have any questions of me or need access to something, feel free to ask. I know one or two people.
So it seems. No, thank you very much. Thank you for giving me the chance to talk about the film and to kind of relive some of the moments. So yeah, I mean, is it too blatant a plug to talk about how people can see the movie?
Absolutely not. It's on Vimeo, and we will include a link in the show notes. But you tell me more and tell the listeners.
Yeah, well, that'll be. I mean, that's the easiest thing. So just it has played on PBS. It played first in Wisconsin. It could be coming to a station near you, but the rollout for those things are rather slow. So if you want to see the film, Vimeo is the best way to do it. A link in the show notes would be great. Yep. But the other thing you can do is go to facebook.com/raggededgefilm. You know, it would be awesome to have you jump on there, maybe leave a note, let us know that you heard the podcast. That's how you came to hear about the film. We've got some, you know, reviews and some other interviews and things like this on there, background information. So if you can jump onto Facebook, that'd be really cool. If you go to Vimeo, it's available for rent or for download.
And those of you that know me know I don't pimp films if they suck. So, and I will tell you straight up that this one is worth downloading and watching because you're all road racing fans that are listening. So go watch it. And it's inexpensive. It's a very inexpensive download.
Yeah, $5 for a rental, $20 for you to keep it. We appreciate you taking the time to watch it, Jim, and you're obviously a man of impeccable taste. So your endorsement means a lot.
I'm rarely told that, so thank you very much.
maybe my taste is in question now, but that's. Yeah. That's all right.
No, I think you'll do fine. All right, Matt. If you ever get out to California, please let me know, and we'll sit down and have a pint and talk about this kind of thing more.
I'd love to do it. Thanks so much for having me, Jim.
All right.
So thanks ever so much, Jim, for bringing us Matt Sinkovitz. And The Ragged Edge is certainly something that having got the link to Vimeo, I'm gonna watch when I can find a spare 55 minutes. You know, I think we all like the idea of, okay, Eric Buell's not quite building bikes in his back garden shed, but it was like the Michael Siss project on the TT0, which we became quite heavily involved with through Mark Miller's involvement as a rider. And it's just that lovely romantic idea that, you know, a small manufacturer can actually go and do something. So what's happened with EBR is you know, real shame. But I look forward to being entertained about, you know, the bits before it all went
wrong.
Entertainingly
enough, part of the opening part of the film is the back garden shed that he was originally building bikes in, building his own calipers. I mean, he is a builder's builder, if you will.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. You know, I think engineers, they're a different breed to me. Certainly. You know, the engineers thing, I mean, when you're talking aviation, engineers would never ever want to fly anything they hadn't built. I would never ever want to fly anything I had built, because even if I got a kit with instructions, I'd end up with a load of spare bits left over, and I'd wonder if I should have found somewhere for them. You know, but I think engineers, people like Guy Coulon and Jerry Burgess and Eric Buell, and you know, all these people. I suppose Jerry Burgess is slightly different, but certainly Guy Coulon strikes as a mad inventing professor.
When I was a kid, I used to make models, model airplanes and model cars and things like that. I always ended up with a couple of parts left over. And I would never paint them because that was just way too much work. I would just play with them or display them somewhere. So I had all these white airplanes or white models or whatever colored plastic.
Yeah, you could never bother. You meant to paint them before you put them together. It's like, no, I want to make it look like a Spitfire now. Yeah. Not, you know, yep. In a couple of days' time. But I think it's also worth remembering with inventors and innovators, you know, we look at some really wacky ideas that clearly didn't work for, you know, motorcycles. I mean, I know the hub steering idea is great in theory. It's very difficult to make it work in the real world. But you think, if you look back and you can do, I don't know if anyone's familiar with Dan Carlin and the Hardcore History podcast series, but Dan has this knack of being able to look at something with contemporary eyes, not through the 2020 hindsight of history. And if you can look at some of the wacky designs that came up, say, for the first helicopter, what became the helicopter, it looks just as ridiculous.
Mm.
The only difference was it worked. Well, Sikorsky made it work. It wasn't his invention, but he invented something that made it work, the Delta hinge. So, you know, someone will come out with something in the next few years and we'll all go, what? That looks ridiculous. And it will catch on. And then years to come, when that's become the norm, we'll look at some of the other things people try and go, ha, 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 ha. But until you try it, you don't know. So I think it's always worth remembering that. So you know, God bless the Eric Buells of this world.
Yeah.
May they long continue to innovate.
I remember some of the original helicopter designs that were like basically kind of a corkscrew fan on top. And all they would do is sit there and hop on the ground. Dunk, 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 yeah. Dunk, dunk.
Sort of bounce around
and shake themselves, yeah. To death. Yeah.
Interesting. I remember you, Simon, going back to the Moto 2 discussion when Moto 2 came out, that you were really disappointed that no one really pushed the boundaries and said, let's try something completely different. And at first we might be getting lapped, but if the concept is sound and we can engineer it properly, within a couple of years we might be lapping everyone else, you know. And it didn't happen, unfortunately. Everyone went conventional. And they daren't step out of the line. But, you know, obviously it takes a lot of money and a lot of thick skin, I think, to go and do something like that. Anyway, talking of thick skin, the stat attack that was mentioned last week, and this is things that have come out in various comments that we've been making over the year and comments on social media and by commentators, not just on television, you know, but the journal, the written word. And I thought it'd be interesting just to look at the four current aliens, as they're referred to, which is Rossi, Lorenzo, Marquez, and Pedrosa. I think everyone's accepting Pedrosa less so now. He's like a Spock, half human, half alien. and I thought, well, I'll look at them and compare them to the best of the rest, which is probably Andrea Dovizioso. He's been around long enough to have a decent size sample. And just for larks, Hayward, Nieto, and Agostini. So what I looked at was total GP starts, and that's all I've got for Ago, Hayward, and Nieto, because they all raced in multiple classes at the time, and then broke it down into just Premier class. So Rossi's started 317 GPs, he's won 110, so he'll win every 2.8 races. Danny Pedrosa, 231 starts, 49 wins, so he wins every 4.7. Lorenzo, every 3.9, so he's between Rossi and Pedrosa. And unsurprisingly, Marc Marquez, 119 total starts, 46. He's got the best results so far of our modern aliens of 2.6. Every 2.6 races, he'll win. Now, as we were speaking earlier, if I sound a bit distracted, it's as we'd mentioned Casey Stoner and Harry nominating for greatest racer ever. So I've actually been number crunching Casey because I did sadly leave him out. 176 total starts. 45 wins, so he takes 3.9 races to win one, exactly the same as Lorenzo, which is fascinating. So if you're going to put Casey up by that dint, if you're going to put Casey up there, Jorge's got to share the top step with him. But then you say Angel Nieto, he won a race every 2.1 races. Mike Hayward was exactly every two races, and Giacomo Agostini every 1.5 races. So he would win 2 out of every 3 races he entered throughout his career. I mean, flipping heck.
Yep.
But we go back to the point made earlier discussing the greatest of all time. It was a different era. He was on a bike far superior to just about everyone else's. If you look at podiums, though, you get a very different picture. Now, Dovi, he's raced in 227. He's 4 behind Danny Pedrosa. He's 8 ahead of Jorge Lorenzo. Even though they started the same time, that's by dint of being injured less, particularly in the early years. He's only had 10 wins, so he takes 22.6 races to win one. That's throughout the classes.
Rather telling.
Exactly. But when you look at podiums, Rossi will podium every 1.6 races. Pedrosa and Marquez every 1.7. Lorenzo. So Rossi's got a better stat than Marquez. So Marquez has a tendency to win it or not be on the podium. Or slightly more so than Rossi. So 1.6 for Rossi, 1.7 for Pedrosa and Marquez, 1.8 for Lorenzo, 3.3 for Dovi. So a bit worse, but not that bad. Stoner, a bit like Marquez, 1.98. So almost every other race he'd podium. And let's face it, Casey did have quite a lot of win it or bin it. Nieto, 1.3. Hailwood was 1.4 and Ago was 1.2. So Ago would, you know, podium on 5 out of every 6 races. That's how you end up with as many titles as you did. For the 5 aliens, or the 4 aliens and Dovi, I then break it down just into the Premier class. I don't know if anyone's actually still awake or listening at this stage, but Rossi's raced in 84 GP or 500s. And is that right? No. Sorry. GP and 500 only wins is 84, which gives him a win ratio of every 2.6 races. For Danny, he's won 26. That's 5.8, considerably worse. Lorenzo again splits those two with 3.6. He'll win a GP, a MotoGP or 500cc. Obviously, you never run in that race every 3.6. Marquez is winning 1 in 2. Dovi, 128, because he's only won once and he's raced in 128 Premier Class races. So I think that really highlights. Now, okay, people could say he's been on inferior equipment. Well, not so much when he's at HRC. Casey Stoner, he'd win every 3 MotoGP races. That's better than anyone but Rossi and Marquez. In fact, I didn't do podiums just for the GPs, for the guys. But I just think it really is quite telling that Dovi is, without doubt, a great racer.
Sure.
But 1 in 128. Against that, the other 4 have only ever been factory riders, and one of the leading 2 factory riders since they joined.
Except
for Rossi, you could argue.
Which is why it's nigh and impossible to try and define a GOAT based on numbers alone.
No, exactly. It's so much more than that. And for some people, inevitably, it will come down to personalities. And that's
course.
Where Ross is going to win some votes. And, of course, he's current. He's still contemporary. He's still here.
Right.
The other one, very quickly, I won't go through this exhaustively. I got really quite annoyed when people were saying, why are there so many people on the MotoGP grid who are just there to make up numbers? And I was thinking, no, there are bikes there that are just there to make up numbers. But you can't say it about many of the riders. Of the currently registered 25 riders, only 7 have never been in the top 3 of a GP Series Championship. So 125 or Moto 3, 250 / Moto 2, 500cc Moto GP. Only 7. And most of those have got very good excuses. For example, Danilo Petrucci was FIM Superstock Champion 2011. Sorry, second in the FIM Superstock Championship 2011. Then he became a test rider. He has really got no GP background. Carol Abraham, yeah, he's one of the ones where you think he was 10th in the 2010 Moto 2. That's his best ever result. So, yeah, but he brings, you know, dad's money along, which helps his team. And he's a nice guy. Cal Crutchlow.
If dad isn't running out of money for Bruno.
Yeah, exactly. Cal Crutchlow, British Supersport Champion 2006, third in BSB in 2008, World Supersport Championship 2009, and he came 5th in the GP Championship 2013. You know, the dude has credibility.
Right.
I'm going to come back to the next one. Eugene Laverty, World Supersport, 2nd in 2009, and 2010, and he was 2nd in World Superbike in 2013, largely due to team orders, which everyone found annoying. Yoni Hernandez has done very little, best result, 15th in MotoGP last year, but he came from South America. He didn't you know, he hasn't come up through the European ranks. Another one, of course, is Loris Baz, who was fifth in last year's World Superbike. He's come straight across. Everyone else has been first, second, or third, in some cases multiple times, in other championships. We've got a lot of former champions. Lorenzo Marquez, Nicky Hayden, obviously, Mike D'Amelio in 125s, Rossi, goes without saying. Scott Redding was second in Moto2. Paul Espargaro was a Moto2 champion. Who else have we had? Pedrosa, Vinales, Bautista, lower class and middle class champions. You know, it just really goes on and on and on. The one I find fascinating is Aleix Espargaró. And this really shocked me. The best he's ever done is seventh in last year's MotoGP on the NGM Ford Yamaha. Was it CRT?
I think.
No, open class last year.
Yeah.
He'd never, ever finished in the top 10 in any series before that. And yet, how many people are now starting to say, do you know what? I reckon Aleix is the real talent in the Espargaró brothers, not Paul.
Yeah,
well, they're both. They're both very talented, but Aleix is really, really turning some heads, I think, quite rightly. And I find that weird. So somebody really knew talent when they saw it.
Well, what was it, the final race last year, the year before, that he led in the wet at Valencia? And I was yeah, finally cheering on, going, yes, my prediction is going to come true.
and then it
yeah,
didn't.
And then it didn't.
Yes. At least yours teased you for a bit till the end. It kept you going right to the vinegar stroke, whereas my dreams tend, or my predictions generally sort of let me down really early and just leave by the door and go to a different pub. Right, I suppose we ought to talk about a bit of racing.
We probably should.
We had a World Superbikes went back to Donington. Three quarters of that track is marvellous. A quarter of it you could pretty much was only tacked on to make FIM spec for distance.
It was funny when they were doing the pre-race track walk. I will honestly admit I have not watched World Superbike Race 2 or World Supersport yet, but they were doing the track walk with Tom Sykes beforehand, or the track drive, if you will, and they completely ignored the Melbourne corner and. My roommate, he's like, why didn't they talk about the hairpin? And I'm like, because they just put it there and it was an afterthought, so they had more room to run MotoGP. And he looked at me and I'm like, it's a boring corner. It's a double apex downhill, double apex. It's a fairly good passing opportunity going in, and you'll get a lot of passing going
yeah,
on down there.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But otherwise, it's just not an iconic corner for the circuit.
I mean, the interesting one is Goddard's.
The
next hairpin, the left-hand hairpin on to start finish straight, because it's adverse
yep.
camber, and it does catch people out. But yeah, really, you're interested in red gates, which is the end of the start finish straight.
Absolutely.
All the way that Craner curves, obviously, is famous. France, or the old hairpin France, McLean's. When I did the track days there, absolutely loved McLean's. Didn't like Coppice because it's blind. The first time I went there was my very, very first ever track day at all at the Ron Haslam School. And I was following Ben Wilson, who was my instructor, and he seemed to be turning onto the grass. And I thought, what the fuck's he doing? And then from there, Foggy S's is all right. And then you go down to Melbourne, Goddard's, and it's kind of just, yeah, you watch them. It's a bit dull. Anyway. We had Super Pole 1 on the Saturday. Sylvain Guintoli progressed successfully through there with Davide Solom. Jordi Torres just missed out. First time I think he's been to Donington. Nico Tirol, Mercado, Ramos, Ponson, de Pugnier. Goodness me, Randy, what you're doing. Nicola Canepa and is it Serge Barraga were the ones who didn't make it through. So in Super Pole 2, we had a absolutely blistering lap by Tom Sykes, put him on pole. Johnny Ray and Davide Giuliano were second and third. Leon Haslam, who probably has more laps round that circuit than any other current racer in any series ever. Anywhere.
Relatively handy having your dad have a race school there.
Yeah, although it doesn't help having three cracked ribs and a sore thumb still. We had Leon Haslam, Alex Lowes, and Chaz Davis making an all-British second row. Leon Camier, Miguel Baiocho, and Sylvain Gintoli were third row, and Davide Salom, Ayrton Badavini, and Michael van der Mark were fourth. I mean, the race took off, and the race won. Johnny Ray, or Leon led initially, didn't he? Johnny got past, but him and Tom Sykes were just in different class. And I got to say, Tom Sykes was in different class from Johnny. And
but
he,
the first lap was just brilliant.
Yeah, first lap was mental. It was, you know, fairing bashing and really, yeah, just superb to see. We lost throughout the race. We only lost three, and normally Krennicker's claims some more because it is a really strange, you know, that the races say a lot of people can never quite work it out, and they get to the bottom and think that was really quick, but I'm not quite sure what I did to make it. Yeah. So Chaz Davis was third, and he really, really hung on for a while manfully, but then dropped back. Ended up at sort of 12 seconds behind Johnny Ray. Leon Haslam was fourth, Ayrton Badavini was fifth, Alex Lowe sixth, Jordi Torres, Sylvain Gintoli, Leon Camion, Davide Salom, Mercado, Terol, Ramos, De Puña, and Canepa were the other point scorers. We lost Barragán, Baiocho, and van der Mark. Yeah, he didn't have a great weekend, young van der Mark. Now, obviously, we have World Supersport next, but we'll just go through the World Superbikes first. And it was kind of the same again, except the first lap wasn't quite as dramatic. Tom Sykes led off and stayed at the front for the entire race. What was quite dramatic was Johnny Ray making every effort to launch himself into low Earth orbit, as David Emmett said so wonderfully the other week.
Oh, that's right.
Extraordinary
save. I did see that. Okay, I took it back. I did watch the beginning of this.
I mean, it was a high side that somehow didn't develop into him being flung skywards and everything.
I was shocked that he was actually able to keep it on track. He went very, very wide out of he pulled that off.
But it did it to him twice. Yeah. It did it to him twice. He was third at the end of the first lap. He was seventh at the end of the second lap, and then it did it to him again. Yeah. It was like that, which he didn't lose places on. And he fought his way back and chipped away and chipped away and just started doing that relentless metronomic, you know, Lorenzo style, picking people off. And he ended up second. You know, really, really impressive race. Goodness knows what was going on. I don't know. They'd made some small adjustments from race one. Didn't work. Chaz Davis was third again. So we had identical, and Leon Haslam fourth. So we had identical top four on each race. Davide Giuliano was fifth, Alex Lowe sixth, Jordi Torres was seventh, Sylvain Gintoli was eighth, Badavini, Baiocho, Ramos, Salom, Mercado, De Puña, and Barragán. And Randy De Puña, by scoring points in each of the two races, has actually managed to pull away from Troy Bayliss in the overall standings. Now, we lost Ponson, Terol, Canepa, van der Mark again, and Leon Camier, bless him. Bloody bike gave up on him again. But van der Mark, Nico Terol, flipping heck, his crash was dramatic. I don't know if you see.
Yeah, no, I did, and that was a very weird crash.
Really.
As Woodham said, I mean, the bike just started pogoing through the track, and normally a bike will continue on its original trajectory, which is going towards the outside. This thing bounced back towards the inside of the circuit. You never see that. It just doesn't happen.
No, and that could have been really nasty. I mean, a couple of people ran wide and ran off the track. One bike was coming directly behind him, really just almost had to stop to weave his way through the carnage and the wreckage. Yep. Thank goodness Nico Terol was okay. And where that leaves us is the standings. Johnny Ray still has a 101-point lead from Leon Haslam. 1 point behind him now is Tom Sykes. So Johnny's on 280, Haslam's 179, Sykes 178, Chaz Davis 155, So not too far behind the guys in front. Jordi Torres, great first season, 117. Silvinger Tady, reigning champion, 92 points in six. Matteo Bracho, 72. Alex Lowe, 71. And Leandro Mercado, 70. So Marco Vandermark, 67. You know, I mean, Ginters is 25 points ahead of him. He's like a race win ahead of him. So Ginters is having a better season, but I think people are just a bit surprised. The race I really, really did enjoy was World Supersport. Watch it, Jim. It is worth it. Not for what happens up front. And the front row for after qualifying was Kina Sofuoglu, Kyle Ride on a wild card from BSS, and Jules Clouzel, Stapleford, can't remember his first name, Zanetti and PJ Jacobson were the second row. Gino Rea was in the middle of the third row with Kyle Smith on the outside. Robbie Rolfo, you know, more familiar names going down. But we set off and Keenan did what Keenan does. Jules Clouzel was pushing hard, but Keenan was absolutely masterful. He never completely pulled away. In fact, it was less than a second between them at the end of it. But I don't know, he just never looked threatened. You always got the feeling that he was winning at the slowest possible pace. What was really dramatic was just behind them, Kyle Ride and I can't remember his first name either, Lorenzo Zanetti, were battling to and fro. I haven't put the lap chart up. If you did, you know, if it showed every end of every segment, it would just be number 77, number 87, number 77, number 87, number 77. You know, brilliant. Really good. Kyle Ride really showing maturity. You know, didn't lose it. A few seconds behind was PJ Jacobson, who had the best seat in the house. But Jack and James, Jack at one point yelled out, "Kyle Ride runs wide, and Zanetti," and then stopped. And I thought, he's trying to think of something that rhymes with Zanetti. And I was waiting for James to say, "Eats a lot of spaghetti." And he didn't. I was really disappointed. So, so you know, James can't. You know,
I'll mention that to him when I call him tomorrow.
I was just so funny because it was one of those ones I don't think Jack intended to rhyme. He just went, "Car Ride runs wide." And then I think he sort of realized, went, "And Zanetti, oh, bugger, I can't think of anything." You know, I just thought this calm Yorkshire voice from next door could say, "Eats a lot of spaghetti." Anyway,
I'm not sure how calm in that particular situation
James can be. No, we're a lot calmer than Jack, I'll put it that way. We lost Wagner, Mahaeus, Ituriots, Mengi, Fachani, Wah, Baldellini, Kyle Smith, Ivanov, and Schmitter. It was a attritional race, let's say. Yeah, lots of people went down. The standings, Keenan is developing a fairly commanding lead. He's on 130 points. But Jules Clouzel has moved into second place now, because obviously he had a couple of DNS earlier in the season with bikes giving up the ghost. Ooh, it's an MV Agusta. What a surprise. He's 45 points behind on 85. Peter Jacobson is 6 points behind him on 79. Then Lorenzo Zanetti, Gino Rea, a fourth and fifth. Ratapart Willerott, 46, and of course didn't turn up. So we're not really sure what's happened there. His place was taken on the Honda by a Yamaha rider.
I'm going to wave my own national flag for PJ Jacobson, who is quietly holding down a pretty solid third place in the championship.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely. He's doing a great job. Sorry, Andy Reid it was, who rode for the Core Motorsport Thailand team in place of Ratapart Willerott, who's been a race winner. And yeah, it's mysterious. Don't know what's going on there. Anyway, there was no BSB this weekend. The race is coming up. We've got Mugello this weekend. Thank you for the weather outlook, Jim. It looks to be good, although long-term weather says there may be patchy rain around Sunday. But Friday and Saturday look good. There's the Californian Mile Flat Track at Sacramento on the 30th of May. That's this Saturday. Jim's going to be there along with Troy Bayliss. I swear he called Biagio. World Superbikes next is Portimao brilliant track. Lovely, lovely track to watch on the 7th of June. That might be interesting to look at their attendance figures because they don't get a GP race anymore. Since the swine took Estoril away from us. Snetterton is the next BSB at the end of June 21st. And Moto America are also running at Road America on Sunday. So things are hotting up. But of course, the big one for Jim, Isle of Man TT practice starts on Monday, the 1st of June. We've got Frank Shingle, and Mika Marie is there to cover it for us for the fortnight. Yep. Marvelous. Yeah, that will be as mental as ever, no doubt.
Of course. I'm looking for, you know me, when I get into TT mode, there's not a whole lot else that goes on. I'll be sitting there listening to Manx Radio TT. If other folks are from the States or overseas, don't be surprised if they bring me on the radio again for my perspective from California.
Yeah, that'd be good. Be good to hear. And yeah, it's great news to hear you're planning to return to the island. I'd read some of your recent comments, and you know, I kind of it's definitely high on the bucket list.
Well,
once you've been, it changes something about you, and it's all for the better. You know.
I know that Dave Neal. Says that he's going to be there next year as well. So you would have both Jim Race and Dave Neal doing the TT coverage. That would be killer.
Right. Well, you might have to make it a hat.
Hey, come on over. You're more than welcome.
Well, actually, it's going to start working in the next couple of years because Ramadan's moving forward and we generally shut down during Ramadan for a bit.
Perfect.
So it's now starts mid-June. So actually, yeah, it might be perfect next year to do that. Anyway, with the interview with Matt Sinkovitz, I think we are over 2 hours, so we should probably wrap it up
there.
Look forward to Mugello this weekend and everything else that's on. And we will speak to everybody next week.
Thank you, Martin. And thank you all for downloading and listening to the show.
Yeah, and don't forget, if you do have any spare money lying around that you don't really know what to do with, you can go to motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side of the page, there's a donate button, or you could subscribe. And if you said, you know, if you were to say, look, I've got $12, I'm just going to chuck you $12. If you say, well, I'll subscribe $1 a month, that's actually really good because we can predict that income then, and that helps us budget effectively, you know, so we don't sort of have a really good month to go, wow, let's send this person to the, you know, Sepang MotoGP because we can, business class because we had this good month, and then suddenly realize we're bankrupt the next week because we can't pay our
the obviously, odds of any of us going business class anywhere are pretty damn low.
yeah courier class where you actually hide in a box and get it sent by DHL maybe, but
we might be hiding in the wheel well, but we'll try and get there anyway.
Yes, absolutely. All right, everybody, thank you very much, and we will speak to you next week.
All right, Martin, thanks for joining me.
Cheers, Jim. Good night. All. Incidentally, Sheridan Marias, I don't know if we want to mention this, in December last, Grillini Racing severed ties with Sheridan Moraes 2 months after announcing he would race for the World Superbike team in 2015. Then PTR Honda picked him up for the World Supersport, and in February this year, he was told, he was sent in a press release, what everybody already knew, that he was asked to leave even before the beginning of the season. So, no, I don't know what's happened to him. So he's definitely a free agent.